Well, the last time you were here was in December of 1983.
Oh, was that with my book of essays, I guess?
It was a book of humor.
Oh, the humor anthology, yeah.
That's right. Also, at that time, you were in the process of working on a musical version of
Yes.
What happened to that?
Well, we did it in Philadelphia at the American Festival of Music. And it didn't quite work. Now it's being reworked, and I think it's going to be done in Cleveland within the next 6 months with some new songs and things. I don't know. But I backed away from the whole thing. I've had enough. I had written the book. I mean the book for the musical.
For the musical.
And it's just too punishing. I can't get into that business again.
You wonder how these things ever get done anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it takes producers, it takes backing, it takes directors and
lots
actors.
Of paddles, many paddles in the water. Yeah.
This was not your first attempt at the play.
No, there was an earlier attempt at the musical in Edmonton. We ran for about 5 weeks there.
Was this Duddy?
Yep. Same thing.
It was the same play, same musical.
A different composer and lyricist, so it's been done twice.
So the music was different?
Yep.
That's punishing, all right.
It is. Yeah. 6 weeks in Edmonton is not my idea of heaven in the wintertime.
In the wintertime.
Well, any time.
Well, Montreal is not the greatest either, is it?
Oh, sure. Montreal's a delightful city. Oh, you mean the winter?
In the winter.
Well, yes, but I mean at least the city is charming, and there are good places to eat and good bars to drink in. And there are lots of redeeming qualities, you know?
Well, there are a lot of redeeming qualities about Solomon Gursky was here, your latest book. This is a really complex story. There were so many characters in it. I had some confusion, but I was delighted that you had the Gursky family tree up front so that I could check the characters, because there were so many members of this family. How did you work this out? Were you the author, of course. Had to be some confusion yourself to keep track of all these people.
Probably more confused than you were. It was extremely difficult, and it does require a certain amount of work from the reader. It's a novel that covers 150 years in, 19th century London, the Arctic, Montreal, the prairies. So it does require a certain amount of work. I had to go through it again and again to make sure dates were right and the people were the right age and the right place. I mean, at one point I had someone getting married who turned out to be 12 years old, which is a bit precocious. Even for a Gursky. So, I had to go through it again and again to weed out the errors.
How did you arrange it? Did you use big charts and graphs and things like this?
No, I didn't, because I was constantly reconstructing the novel. So I every now and then I'd go through it and make notes about who was where at what time and what age they were. And then when I finally hand the novel into what I considered its publishable shape or final shape, I did go through it several times and weed out most of the errors. And then, fortunately, Knopf caught other errors. Then we decided to put in this family tree to help readers along.
Now, the novel moves along in a non-chronological way. Did you write it that way?
Yes, I did.
You actually wrote it that way so that you would go back and forth in time?
Yes, but that wasn't always the structure of the novel. I mean, at one point it began with a chapter that's maybe chapter 8 now, which is Mr. Bernard's birthday party. And I finally settled on this structure for the novel. This novel took me 5 years. And really, you don't know you're finished until it begins to bore you, and it's a pain to go upstairs. And then you know there's just so much you can do, and then it's time to let it go.
This is your biggest novel to date, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I guess it's my most ambitious novel to date, certainly, yes.
You mentioned Mr. Bernard. He is the liquor kingpin in this dynasty. I've been reading some of the review material. I understand that the characters are roughly based on the Bronfman liquor family. Is that right?
No. Well, I mean, there are more than passing similarities between Mr. Bernard and the late Sam Bronfman, but that's the extent of the similarities to the Bronfmans. Certainly all the other characters are total inventions.
Now, this is also in many respects a historical novel because you deal with a lot of Canada's history. Tell me about your research efforts.
Well, there's a lot of it, or a big chunk set in the Arctic during the time of the Franklin expedition. What happened is we returned to Canada from England. We lived in England for 20 years. In 1972, and I began to go up to the Northwest Territories for the first time. And I found it an enchantment. I was fascinated with the territories and began to read rather deeply into its history. And some years later, it surfaced in the novel. I did have to do a good deal of research for this novel about life in 19th century London and the Arctic and so on. It's something I did very grudgingly because I'm rather suspicious of novelists who do research. I think you should know things firsthand, but what could I do? There was not music I'd heard or tunes I knew. So there were certain difficulties, in getting the dialogue right for the period.
Tell the listeners something about this Franklin expedition.
Well, it was after the Crimean War, the British were left with a rather large fleet and with very little to do. And so they decided they would search for the Northwest Passage. It was a ridiculous notion because it would never have been negotiable in any commercial way. But it was somewhat heroic as well. And they went out searching for a passage to the Far East through the Arctic seas. Unfortunately, Franklin, who set out for the third time when he was 59 years old, went out in a year where the ice came in very early, settled in very early. And in a kind of arrogant British fashion, they went out with their very best-dressed naval uniforms and equipment and party gear and knew nothing about conditions in the Arctic and how to survive as the natives did. And they were locked in the ice after 3 years, and they all died. And they died because they were ignorant and refused to learn from the natives. They could have survived. And I put a twist on it in my novel, and there is one survivor who was the first Gursky, Ephraim Gursky.
Well, the book is not only about Canada, it's about Jewish life in Canada, but I suspect that Jewish life in Canada is probably not that much different from Jewish life in the United States.
No, it isn't. I'm not certainly not in the big cities, certainly not in Montreal or Toronto. I mean, I think it's similar to Jewish life in Boston or Chicago or any large Eastern American city, given certain differences. Montreal is a French city, so there are differences of sort.
Now, swooping through the novel is a very black raven, and this certainly holds a lot of symbolism in the book. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, I've been up to the Arctic four or five times, and one of the first things you notice is that the ravens are ubiquitous up there. And it sneaked into my novel, because the more I read about ravens in Indian and Eskimo mythology, they've always been a symbol of mischief and wickedness and of playfulness, and I thought this was very appropriate to this novel and to the character of Solomon Gursky, who was always playing tricks on people.
Now, you mentioned that you've spent the last 3 years on this book.
Yes.
But actually, you had a number of false starts, didn't you, over the years?
Absolutely. Yes, I really began this novel some 10 or 12 years ago, and I get so far and hit a brick wall and start all over again and hit that wall again. So I put it aside. And then 4 years ago, we moved out to our country place, which is on Lake Memphremagog, just by the Vermont border, and I resolved to stay there until I finished the novel, or the novel finished me, and it was a close call, but I stayed out there and finally finished it last May.
Tell me a little bit about the creative process. You said you had a number of false starts, hits and misses as you began, and finally, you went out to the country and just hammered away at this thing, but how do you hammer away at the creative impulse?
Well, like most writers, I go to work every day, but there aren't favorable winds every day. But in order to earn those good days, I think you just have to get up there and work. And so I just battered through, and I was going to give up several times, but fortunately, or unfortunately, my wife encouraged me not to give up and to pursue the novel. And she was enormously helpful, really.
Who was it who locked his wife in the bedroom and said, write?
I think that was Mary McCarthy's husband.
Just get in there and write, and when you have a chapter, you can...
My wife never locks me in the room.
But you must have been thinking about this. Does a writer ever stop thinking in between? For example, you're on a tour now, you travel on airplanes, and you go out by taxi or limo to wherever you have to get to, but don't you make use of this available time in thinking about your projects?
Not really now, but when I'm at home in my own environment, yes. You are thinking about your next project. You know, I have certain notions, but they're all on the back burner when you're undergoing this kind of business.
You lived in England for something like 20 years, I think.
That's right, yes.
When you went back to Canada, which was, what, in the 1970s?
1972, yes.
Yeah. Did you have a culture shock re-entering Canada?
Well, no, because it's somewhat deceptive in that in the latter 10 years, I would be back in Canada at least once a year and once for a stay of several months. So it was not unfamiliar territory any longer. I came back because I finished a novel called St. Urban's Horseman, and I thought I really couldn't write any more novels set in England because I hadn't been brought up there. And then other writers who were Commonwealth writers or expatriate novelists whom I respected and whose work was really very good alarmed me because I saw they were suddenly writing novels set in biblical times or in mythical countries or even on other planets, and I thought, my God, I better go home where a larger society was available to me. I mean, problem in England, it was very enjoyable, but I found that most of my friends were either other writers or directors or journalists, and it was a very narrow artistic community and not the kind of thing I wanted to write about. Whereas once I got home, I could drink with lawyers and plumbers and go out to the Northwest Territories and do all kinds of things and could imagine the childhood of characters because I had been brought up in that country.
Yeah, I guess it's easier for a writer to write about what he knows. I know in Alison Lurie's book, Foreign Affairs, which won the Pulitzer Prize, she has a woman who is who teaches children's literature.
Yes, I know that novel. It's a very good novel.
It's a wonderful book.
Yes.
And she goes off to England to do some research and has a love affair there. It's very nicely done. But it's interesting that I was talking to her and I said, why did you make your heroine a teacher of children's literature? She said, well, it was easy for me. I didn't have to do any research. I didn't have to invent the character because that's what she does at Cornell.
Yes, yes.
So it's easier in some respect.
Yeah, well, you see, one of the disadvantages I have is that I began writing when I was 18 or 19, and I published my first novel when I was 21, which was most enjoyable at the time, and it was quite exhilarating. But I've never had a job. Most writers I know, I've had 5 or 6 years working in offices or somewhere, and they may have resented it, but they can now draw on office life or factory life, and I can't. So I have to research these things.
You have a wonderful essay in Home Sweet Home about your father. It's very, very touching, very moving. And your father's reaction to you as a writer. I think he had a suggestion that you alphabetize the titles of your books, starting with A. And so.
My first novel was called The Acrobats. And he said, your second one with a B and your third one with a C and so on.
So your family's reaction to you, I guess you were the first writer in the family.
On the paternal side, on my mother's side, my grandfather was a Hasidic rabbi who wrote a considerable number of books, yes. So he was a writer. His books were published in Warsaw in the 20s and 30s.
So I guess there's literary blood in your family.
Yes, yes.
What has been the reaction to your books, especially among the Jewish community in Canada? Because many of the characters in Solomon Gursky are very unflattering.
Well, See, I don't find them unflattering. I know some people do. I mean, I think they're people of appetite and
greed.
Greed. but with a sense of fun. And so I don't find them as unflattering. But agreed, some people do. And I had a problem with a novel about the apprenticeship of Denny Kravitz, which was about a young working-class hustler in Montreal. And that led to my troubles with some people thinking I was anti-Semitic, which is not the case. And Denny Kravitz was not meant to be a metaphor for the Jewish people, but was certainly true of the boys I grew up with. So there are some readers who object to my work, and fortunately there are others who enjoy it.
Are you religious?
No, but I
think you said in one of your essays you made reference to the fact that you were an atheist, didn't you?
Possibly. Yes, I had a very Orthodox Jewish upbringing, which I'm grateful for. I come from a family of very observant Jews on both sides. But I'm not observant myself. However, I value the tradition, and I was glad to have been brought up in it.
Canada seems to be developing a lot of literary traditions with a lot of terrific writers.
There's some very good writers.
Atwood is a marvelous writer. And Davies.
Alice Munro. And Davies and Mavis Gallant.
There's another young writer, Guy Vanderhaeghe.
Guy Vanderhaeghe is enormously talented. And of course, there's Michael Ondaatje. Yeah, so there has been a flowering of a kind in the last 15 or 20 years.
What does this mean, that Canada is becoming a vastly more cosmopolitan nation?
I think it's fortuitous. I mean, when I was a kid, we were all reading Southern American novels. They're just these waves from different areas. And for a long time, there were very good work coming out of the Caribbean. And this just seems to be our time of fertility. I don't know how long it will last, but it's certainly splendid.
What's the working climate in Canada? What with the French separatist movement?
Oh, well, that's a problem peculiar to Montreal. No, that's not true. There is some talk of Quebec seceding. I don't take it too seriously, though. Sorry. Quebec nationalism is something that seems to surface and become troubling once in a decade. And we're now in the midst of a very abrasive situation in Montreal. And there is some talk of Quebec seceding or choosing something called sovereignty association, which really means leaving home on an allowance. And I just don't think it's on because of the...
Leaving home on an allowance?
Yes, because sovereignty association would mean that English-speaking Canada, or the rest of Canada, would guarantee Quebec's currency, which is no independence of any kind, because if the bank rate is set by another country, or you are not independent. And sovereignty association is a wishy-washy notion, but Quebec feels resentful at the moment and rejected, which is difficult to understand because for the last 30 years, the Prime Minister of Canada, except for a three-month gap, has come from Quebec. And Quebec wields an awful lot of power in Ottawa. But the problem is there, and I think we're just going to have to continue living with it.
But what about you as a writer? As a writer writing in English.
Oh, I mean, it's not that abrasive. It doesn't affect me personally.
But didn't they have rules that signs had to be in French?
Oh, yes. There's a very amusing law which has been put in place, and it's been there for about 9 months. It's called Bill 178, which means you cannot have a bilingual street sign outside your store. However, if you employ four or less people, you can have a bilingual sign inside your store, providing the English letters are half the size of the French and not in a more dazzling color. So you have grown men, inspectors, going into stores with tape measures to make sure you're not cheating. But it belongs more to the history of farce than to...
What happens if you're a Chinese and you have a Chinese laundry or a restaurant? You want to use the Chinese characters.
Well, they haven't really landed very heavily on the Chinese. But it's ridiculous. It's very silly. And both communities are fighting over this. And it's a quarrel more appropriate to a schoolyard than to grown men and women. However, there it is. The French feel threatened because their case is that the new immigrants coming into Quebec will think they can get by with English and not French if they see English on the streets. But, of course, what it means is if they persist in this, is that the most imaginative of the immigrants from, let's say, Portugal or Italy or Poland or wherever, and the most ambitious are simply going to bypass Quebec because the language of success in America is English, whether we like it or not. So the real problems are not being addressed. But what the French are frightened of is becoming a minority in their own home, as it were, in Quebec.
Now, I was talking to Robertson Davies a while back. He says his books are not well read among the French-speaking population. But strangely, his books are printed in French editions, published in France, and then shipped back to Canada. And that way they are read. He says that's sick.
Well, I have had the same experience. I mean, my novels were published in French in France long before they were published in Quebec. I was invited to book fairs and conferences in France long before anyone in Quebec took notice. Yes, there is that problem. The French, they're very self-absorbed at the moment. There's a lot of navel gazing. And really, in English Canada, we're far more interested in French-Canadian literature than they are in ours.
To what extent is there French-Canadian literature?
Oh, there are two or three very good novelists about, and there's a very talented playwright, Michel Tremblay, and there's a novelist called Yves Beauchemin, who's a talented man. So, I mean, there is a body of...
Are they being translated into English?
They are translated into English in Canada. I don't know that they're published in the United States or England, or not very many of them are. But they're much more widely read in English Canada than English Canadian novels are read in French Canada.
Now, you live in Montreal as well as your country place, right? Is there a literary community within Montreal? You hang out at the same bars and this sort of thing?
No, really the literary community is centered in Toronto. And I avoid those bars. I drink in other bars. But there aren't too many writers in Montreal, English-speaking writers.
What's it like? You finished this huge book. I think it's more than 500 pages, right?
No, I think it's 400 and something.
Yeah, feels like 500 pages. It's still a big book. When you finish a project like this, you spend 3 years. What's it like when you finally wrap it up and it's in the hands of the publisher?
It's a great relief to be done with it. And now you watch and hope it will do well. Because the better it does, the more time it buys me. It's as simple as that.
But it's also your baby, too, isn't it? I mean,
you have a very
proprietary interest
in this. Yes. Yes. But, you know, there's always I finished it a year ago. So now it's become something else, and I'm waiting to see how well it does.
Was it published in Canada first?
It was published in Canada in November because they wanted to rush it out for the Christmas bonanza.
I guess people don't realize that publishing takes a long time. You mentioned that you turned this book in a year ago, and it's just not coming.
Yes, it usually takes 9 months. As a rule of thumb, I'd say there's a 9-month gap between your finishing a book and it.
Plus the time involved in writing it. It's just writing and publishing just seems to be so time-consuming as opposed to the electronic media where it just goes out immediately.
And it's forgotten.
Yeah. That's true. It is forgotten.
Well, you know, we weren't drafted. We volunteered, and it's not really a bad life. My father worked a lot harder.
But books are forgotten, too. I think people also don't realize there's an ephemeral nature to books.
Yes. They have a... unfortunately, short shelf life very often. But happily, Penguin Books is going to reissue 4 of my earlier novels next year, so that's very pleasing. I'm delighted with that.
I was talking to a young writer the other day who said, name is Tim O'Brien, who was saying that he hoped that his current book would be read 100 years. Somebody would find it on the library shelves 100 years from now. Well,
he'll never know.
But the problem is that libraries always go through their shelves.
Yes.
And I was doing some research on a crusty journalist of the 19th century and early 20th century named Ambrose Bierce.
Oh, yeah.
And his collected works were at at only 2 libraries in New York, the Research Library and the Midtown Branch Library. So I was going there occasionally. It's 12 books, a set of encyclopedias. So I'd been going there periodically to read these books and take some notes, and I went there one day and I found that the whole set was gone.
Oh, really?
Gone. So I found a librarian, and I said, "Where's the Ambrose Bierce?" He said, "Oh, I was afraid that somebody was going to come in. Today we took them off the shelves. Not enough people are reading them, and we're going to sell them.
That's
and have a library sale. You'll have to go to the main branch, the research library, to read these." So if someone hopes that his book is going to be on the library shelf 100 years from now...
my hope is just that there will be library shelves 100 years from now. Cyril Connolly's test was a little less stringent. He said the true test of a novel is if it's being read 25 years after publication. But look, it's a crapshoot. We don't know. You try and do your work as well as you can, and you hope for the best.
Solomon Gursky, a very ambitious book. It's a beautiful book. Mordecai Richler, thank you very much.
Thank you.